I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
This is our day in history, October the 7th. On this day, William Sill was born in 1821. He was an African-American abolitionist who helped run the Underground Railroad, bringing more than 800 slaves to freedom. He was a writer, a historian, and a civil rights activist. He was called the father of the Underground Railroad. His life is the life of African-Americans' own agency to end slavery. The people he helped escape, he interviewed each one of them, keeping his records concisely, including a brief biography of everybody who he helped escape, and along with any alias they might have used. He kept the records hidden, and they're part of a book. This is also the birthday of Joe Hill, who was born in 1879, who was executed by the Montana government for his fight for the rights of workers as one of the leaders of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. This is also the birthday, in 1897 on this day, Elijah Muhammad was born, the founder of the Nation of Islam. From 1934 until his death in 1975, he was a leader of the Nation of Islam. This is also the day, in 1889, that Clarence Muse, the actor, was born here in Baltimore, Maryland, who played Sam in Casablanca and many other films. On this day in 1931, Desmond Tutu was born, the Anglican Archbishop of South Africa, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1982 and helped lead the anti-apartheid movement. On this day in 1934, the great writer, poet, playwright, essayist, music critic, Amiri Baraka was born in 1934. Born Everett Leroy Jones. He was Leroy Jones for a long time before he became Amiri Baraka, author of numerous books like Blues People, The Negro Music in White America, and The Motion of History, and many other things. One of my favorite writers of all time, especially his plays. This is the day in 1943, the infamous Ali North was born, the U.S. colonel who was behind Irangate. This is the day in 1955, Yo-Yo Ma was born in Paris, France, world-famous cellist, National Medal of Arts winner, one of the most incredible musicians in our history. And on this day as well, in 1967, the great Toni Braxton was born, who is number one in the U.S. and number two in the U.K. for her single, Unbreak My Heart. On this day in 1849, Edgar Allan Poe, the American author, poet, and critic, died on the streets of Baltimore at the age of 40. And in 1966, Smiley Lewis died on this day. One of the great R&B singers died of stomach cancer. He wrote One Night, covered by Elvis Presley, or stolen by Elvis Presley, whichever way you want to look at it. And I Hear You Knockin', the 1955 U.S. number two for Gail Storm. He was an incredible writer. On this day in 1492, Columbus missed Florida. Didn't know where he was going, so he bumped into some other island. In this day in 1701, in a farewell address to William Penn, Chief Artiog, the Susquehanna chief, along with other Shawnee leaders, requested the colonists refrain from selling alcohol to local Indians. Penn assured them this would go on, and that's what the assembly said, but it didn't happen. In 1800 on this day, Gabriel Prosser was put on trial for assembling 1,000 slaves with plans to march on seize Richmond. Witnesses came forth to undercut him. Gabriel himself, he refused to make a statement. He was sentenced to be executed on the next day, October the 7th, but asked that the sentence be carried out not until October 10th when other slaves were going to be hung. They agreed, then lied to him, separated all the slaves and hung them separately. But he walked to the gallows, head held high, knowing what he was doing was the liberation of Africans and slavery in America. This is the day in 1886 that Spain abolished slavery in Cuba. This is the day in 1944, there was an uprising in Auschwitz. The Jews turned on their camp guards, burning down crematoriums before they were mowed down. This is the day in 1955, poet Allen Ginsberg read his poem Howl at a poetry reading at the Sixth Gallery in San Francisco. This poem was an immediate success that rocked the beat to literary world to world fame and set the tone for confessional poetry later. It was later brought to the court as obscene, but it changed a generation. This is the year 1957, the American Bandstand premiered on TV. And in 1966, CBS broadcast Route 66 for the first time. And in 1963, SNCC created Freedom Day, which created voter registration drives all across America and even here in Maryland, in Cambridge, Maryland, in Baltimore City, that many of us were part of. It was on this day in 1969 that General Earl Wheeler, who later became a fame because he opposed the integration of Mississippi and was indicted, but then was leaving Vietnam, who said that Vietnamization of the war was being steadily and realistically achieved. So the American people once more lied to in 1969 about where the war was. That was continued in 1970 when President Richard Nixon announced a 5-point proposal to end the war that didn't happen for 5 years more. In 1975, on this day, the United States Supreme Court judge reversed a deportation order for John Lennon, allowing him to remain legally in his adoptive home of New York City. And this is a day in 1991 that Anita Hill publicly accused Clarence Thomas, nominee for the Supreme Court, of sexual harassment, of inappropriate and unwelcome sexual comments when she worked for him at the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Thrust her into fame, Clarence Thomas was nominated and still serves on the Supreme Court nevertheless. This is a day in 1993 that Toni Morrison became the first black woman to be awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. On this day in 1998, Matthew Shepard, a gay student at the University of Wyoming, was found tied to a fence after being savagely beaten by two young adults in Laramie, Wyoming. That led to a movement in his name. And that's this day in history, October the 7th. And one of the things we want to try to cover today in our program is, given the government shutdown and given the disorder in Congress and in our country and the huge divide in America, I think you can see in many ways, we want to explore that in some depth with our guests, who are all very interesting, all been on the show before, and all are very thoughtful people who are not afraid to kind of dwell and delve into areas that aren't their usual political territory as well in terms of ideology. So I think that we have this in studio Bob Summerby, who's an editor of the Daily Howler and has been coming on this program for 20 years doing commentaries. Bob, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Dr. Lester Spence is in the studio, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, who has been joining us for quite a while now, and good to have you in the studio as well.
Good to be here, as always.
And Dr. Anne McCarthy is with us, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and former Republican candidate for Comptroller of the State of Maryland. And Anne, good to have you back.
Thank you, Bob. Oh, thank you, Mark.
Mark. We can thank Bob as well. I'm sure he'd
thank
like that.
Thank you, Bob, too. You too, Lester.
So, let's just begin with what we're seeing in America today. And let me start with you. I mean, you've run for political office. You were active in the Republican Party. And I know you've had a lot of your own kind of angst and serious thought and consideration about what's happening inside your own party and how that plays into this dysfunction and what else do you think plays into it.
Well, I was thinking this morning as I was listening to the news that, you know, basically the 30 Republican congressional representatives that are Tea Party or Tea Party-like in their attitudes are what's holding all of this up, that they keep the Republican Party hostage, and that the moderate Republicans, who are increasingly few in number, are held hostage in a different way, because if they don't go along with them, then they go back to their districts and face a challenge from the far right. And so it's like a battle for where this party is going to be, and it's becoming increasingly irrelevant. It's almost embarrassing as a Republican to look at what's happening.
You're saying the party's becoming irrelevant?
I think so. I think by continuing to do these sorts of things, I think about this too. Think about it. They're holding up a continuing resolution for spending. First of all, they haven't done a budget in 5 years, which is their fundamental job. So they should all just be kicked out. But secondly, they're holding this up, and they're about to default on the debt because they're worried about the individual mandate because of the Obamacare. That's only about 30 million people out of 300 million people that are in the United States. So they're representing people who don't even know and won't be impacted by this individual mandate, and it's a small percentage of the United States, and yet we're risking all of this nonsense because of that. They don't know. I don't think they have a grip on reality.
Neither one of my other guests here, I don't know what I would describe them. I know you're not a Republican, Bob.
No. I'm a Democrat.
Okay. And?
I find the whole thing bizarre. I mean, as someone who writes about the media, obviously I think what has been going on in Congress is foolish and silly, and it's hard to get a grip on what exactly is going on, and it represents the kind of breakdown, the polarization that's going on in politics around the country. I've been writing a lot about part of my interest in the last year or two has been the rise. There's been a on the right, there's been a sort of crazy machine going on for 40 years, and conservative voters have been exposed to this, starting with think tanks, then going to talk radio, then going to Fox. They've been exposed to this for 40 years. There's been a big business on the right of crazy making for a long time, bogus claims, you know, silly frameworks. And people are exposed to this and don't know they're being played a lot of times. And it's been interesting to me in the last 5 years to see finally the liberal world, which sort of sleptwalked its way through the Clinton-Gore years, through the last time that a Democratic president was accused of all kinds of crazy things. The liberal world post-Iraq began to wake up, and we now have liberal organizations developing. And it's interesting to me to see on the other side, on the liberal side of the fence, the same crazy-making business enterprise starting to develop. Now, liberals, of course, immediately say, oh, that's ridiculous. That's false equivalence. I'm not saying it's equivalent. It troubles me that on our side of the aisle, any of this could be attracted to anyone at all, and I think it is developing. And it just means that now there's going to be two big business entities channeling bogus claims or highly jaundiced frameworks to voters who trust the people they're hearing this from. So I'm interested in how it's developing on my side of the aisle. But clearly, I mean, what's been going on for 40 years on the right, and it's led to this situation where it's very hard to make sense of what's being done, what's been going on in Congress, for example.
And Lester, I wouldn't put you on either side of the aisle, most likely. I don't know where you put yourself, but...
So what I'm going to do is I'll put on my straight political scientist hat, right? My card-carrying political scientist hat. And I think the challenge in articulating what's going on as crazy, although I understand, you know, both my colleagues saying that, and viscerally sometimes I feel that way, the challenge is that it precludes us from understanding the fundamental structural dynamics that makes this politically possible, and then the very specific political ideas they have, a segment of the Republican Party has, that is not crazy, that is part of a very rational political project, one that I fundamentally disagree with and one that's politically problematic in a number of ways, but it's a political project. So what are the structural dynamics I'm talking about? So every 10 years we have the census, and the census, the census figures enables states to redraw the lines of congressional districts.
Mm-hmm.
In 2010, a significant number, it might even have been like over 3/5 of state houses were run by the Republicans, right? In fact, most of the states are now like single party governments, and a number of them Republicans. This gave them the ability to draw their congressional districts. They drew congressional districts in such a way as to privilege their own party. When the Democrats do it, they do the same thing, right? That's a problem, but that's the way it is. What they ended up doing was drawing a number of districts in ways that, given who the current Republican Party is, attracts ways that are older, ways that are that renders their districts older, ways that render their districts relatively undereducated, ways that render their districts whiter, right? So that's a structural dynamic where you've got a number of districts, and these individuals, they're not, when they're running for election, they're, to the extent they have competition, they actually don't have competition in the other party. They have competitions within the party, right? So it's Republicans against Republicans in the primary, and then whoever comes out of that, once they get in office, they tend to stay, right? So that's an important structural dynamic, right? And then the other structural dynamic is kind of a media dynamic where we have the consolidation, the creation of, on the one hand, of all these different media entities through the internet, and then the consolidation of corporate media forms that concentrate media messages ideologically, right? Where people who tend to be conservative, they tend to listen to Fox News, I mean, they tend to watch Fox News. They tend to listen to Rush Limbaugh and a number of other conservatives. If you tend to be on the left end of the liberal spectrum, you tend to listen to MSNBC, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So those two structural dynamics combined with other structural dynamics make it possible that a small group of Republican representatives who, again, represent those districts that are whiter, relatively undereducated, and older, they have a view of the world that they're hearing from everything they consume. And that view of the world is not put up against other political views and then tested in the arena of the vote. So, and that view of the world is that government should be incredibly small except for the stuff they want, and that any incursion in government, any tax that's designed to benefit the quote-unquote public good is a socialist incursion on democracy. That's what it is. So it's not – it sounds crazy, but it actually is not crazy, and it's the result of structural dynamics. And we should – I apologize for going too long, but we have a problem when we articulate it solely as crazy.
But I agree that the ideas aren't crazy. I mean, I use that term in various ways. Right. And people are, of course, free to think what they want to think and to believe what they do believe. And there are critiques, let's say, of the Affordable Care Act or of quote-unquote big government that are perfectly – there's certainly sensible elements of the critique of big government, quote-unquote. That's, you know, so it's all based on – there are perfectly reasonable and longstanding American views that are being articulated here. What does start to get crazy in a sense that I'll defend is when people are constantly given – misleading or bogus information. There's a lot of that. It started to happen a little bit in certain ways from the left side, and it's been going on for a long time on the right side. And there's not much effort, let's say, in the new liberal media to talk to people on the other side of the aisle and find out, what do you really think about what's going on in American politics? What do you really think about the Affordable Care Act? And where did you hear that? And why do you think that? And what is your real objection? There's very little attempt to talk across those lines. Each side is interested in ridiculing the other side tribally, and that's where we're sort of drifting.
Well, I wonder, as I'm listening to all of you, and let me get your comment before I ask this question this way. I mean, and what did you think about what was just posited?
I understand and I agree with what's being said. I would also say, really, the structure of our Constitution enables, as opposed to stop, divided government. And so when we talk about structural issues, it's beyond just voting districts. I mean, I live in one of the whitest states in America.
Minnesota.
Oh, it's like 97% white, I believe. And yet, the governor's a Democrat. The House and the Senate are Democrats within the state. We mostly elect Democrats to the national stage. We have a progressive state income tax where the more you make, the higher your marginal rate is. And we have no problem taxing for the common good. So I hear what Lester's saying. But I also think it's not just a white issue or a black issue. I think it's perhaps an education issue and thinking about training people to think critically about what they're really hearing. And maybe our education system is failing us in that way.
I think there's a complexity here. Race is a big part of it, but it's also something that is intertwined with that as well as changing things. But that's why I want to ask this question. But Lester, go ahead.
Yeah, and I did not mean to – you're right about the Constitution. I did not mean to imply that it was solely a racial issue, right? So it's not – so when we talk about those Republicans, when we talk about where those Republicans are coming from, it's a very specific region of the South, right? You don't really have anyone in the Northeast. You don't have anyone in the North Central or in the North, right? So it's a very specific set. But given where that specific set comes from, race interacts with their already existing ideas that are anti-government, mm-hmm. right? And that's a structural issue, And I think that is a racial issue, but it's not race in a very simple way.
And state comes from Scandinavia, so that's a whole different. I mean, there's different political traditions within white America from different parts of the world, and that's helped shape American politics within white America.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think that's true.
Although we do have Michelle Bachmann.
You do.
She's your outlier.
There's an exception to every rule.
Yeah, that's right.
And George Wallace did get. If I have this correct, the number, I'll look it up to make sure I have it correct, 36% of the Democratic primary vote in Wisconsin in 1972.
Oh, wow. That makes sense.
So maybe it was more than that. It might have been 42%. I'll look that up. It's a huge number.
Wisconsin is south of Minnesota. you might want to consult your maps.
But let me suggest something here. I mean, I think that maybe America's going through a crisis that we haven't figured out how to get ourselves through, that's deeper than some of the stuff that most of the mainstream media talks about. Let me just put two points together and see what you all think, that this might be part of the root of it. A, we have come from a period from the 1940s through the 30s even, to the 1970s, of unprecedented economic growth. United States being the top economic dog on the planet Earth for a long time. The unions and industry and the battles around that built a middle class along with government jobs that didn't exist before. Huge. It allowed poor whites and African Americans come from the South to build a middle class that didn't exist before. And all that kind of exploded onto the scene. The world began to change and that started to fall apart. And we didn't have that stability anymore. And we have not been able to figure out how to regain that stability since the world economy has taken over and the world corporate world internationally has taken over and redefined economics for the planet. We haven't figured out what our place is there. That's one set of things that happened. And the other set of things to me that seems to happen was that in that same time period, post-World War II through the 1960s, was the birth of the civil rights movement that ended segregation. And that end of segregation, America always defined itself up until now, where it's battling itself, defined itself as a white nation. Yeah, there's some black folks here. We have Indians here, whatever. But we're a white country, and this is our heritage. This is who we are. And that's been torn asunder, completely torn asunder. And so in both cases, America has not been able to redefine itself as who it is, either economically or politically, in terms of our culture and race. And we're in that place, I think, where we're in this kind of
– Don't leave out gender.
I can name a couple of
things. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Gender exploded in there. The environmental consciousness, a number of things happened. And so things were torn asunder in some ways from the norm that America was used to, not seeing the norm was correct, the norm that America was used to. And we haven't been able to find our place. And part of the reaction going on in Congress and part of the reaction going on in this country right now is a reaction to that, both in terms of race and the economy, from the far right in many ways. And I think that's why I think it's so intense, because we don't have an answer to it. And it's not like one more thing. It's not like the 1950s when you could have compromise in the 40s and compromise in Congress, when Congress was a place where white men controlled the situation. They no longer do.
A white male elite was in charge.
And so they could talk to each other even if they disagreed about liberal versus conservative. But something different, it's a different dynamic now.
You know, I'll say, speaking as a white liberal, and white liberals are right now very intolerant of white conservatives, and we get out our R-bombs very quickly. And dismiss everything that's happening on the other side of the aisle as a reaction to race and the first black president. I think for all the change that's gone on in America, just the unbelievable amount of demographic and social upheaval of the years you're talking about, I have to say I think for all the political turmoil that's going on, I think America is doing a sort of a – man, I look around at who Americans are electing to office, including the skinny guy with the funny name. I have to say, I find myself criticizing my political tribe because we're so eager to trash the other side for its racism. And there's certainly racism in the world or whatever its near kin is. Think of the change. And America was a white male elite nation when we were going through that period of economic growth. run by a white male elite in Congress, and they, you know, after six were all friends. And they're not all friends after six now. They're not friends at all, and are breaking up regionally in certain ways. But given the amazing upheaval, social change, demographic change of the last, let's say, 50 years, I got to say I think we're doing fairly well, as ridiculous as things are right now, at not going crazy, I think an awful lot is being accepted by a lot of people. And I've seen a lot of positive acceptance. You know, look at the change in attitudes toward gays. I mean, you talk about a fast, not as fast as we might hope, but you talk about a fast evolution of values. So I think from my side of the aisle, liberals ought to be a little more appreciative of that at times. We're not dealing with – well, I'll stop there.
That's cool.
No, I agree. 20 years, we went from Don't Ask, Don't Tell to gay marriage amendments throughout the, you know, whatnot.
I mean, in the 90s, gay spokespeople on cable TV were still taking a lot of crap from conservative politicians, and that's gone. I mean, that's just not – and they were very skillful at not – and how they dealt with it. And that's just largely gone now. And that's a very short period of time. I'm mostly interested in gay teenagers not being tormented and to the point of where they want to kill themselves. That's my first starting point in that area. But, well, anyway, that's – I think there's been a lot of good change.
I would say that, too. This year, our incoming first-year class, so what, they were born – if they're 18 and this is 2013, they were born, what, in – 1995?
Jeez.
Something like that.
They missed the first shutdown.
11% of them listed themselves as multiracial. Not white, not African-American, not Hispanic, multiracial. That's, like, unprecedented. I think we, in fact, don't know, given, like, I'll admit, I'm an aging baby boomer. I don't necessarily, and I'm on a college campus, I don't still get the degree to which the new generation, for a lot of them, these issues are not as important to them as they are to us. Because they're intermarrying. They come from interracial marriages. They come, you know, they're just like the gay issue is not a big deal for them. They have friends who are gay. They're gay themselves. You know, it's just, this is not as big of a deal to them as it is to the, you know, older American that can't kind of deal with this change.
Well, but it is – yeah, so it is a big deal, though. So let's go back to that – to the early moments of the what's now called the Great Recession, right? And you know, there's – and there are a number of different stories floating around about how exactly the Great Recession was caused and all the dominant economic theories that were of the time, just a few years ago. They neither predicted, because they didn't predict this thing happening, they couldn't actually provide us with solutions as to how to get our way out. And in that moment, you have two quote unquote movements. One represented by that we could say is represented by the Tea Party. The other is represented by what we could say is Occupy Wall Street. In the case of the Tea Party, what we had happen was a series of individuals, of wealthy individuals, kind of, it's far too simple to say buying a party or buying a movement, but again, it's radio. What they did was they deployed resources to seed stories out that fit with what a very conservative, predominantly white, set of Americans thought the world. It gave them a story about what caused what happened, and gave them a story about solutions. The solutions was make government smaller. Government is actually the problem, right? And then embedded in that is a set of ideas about democracy and about how democracy is supposed to work. That in a weird, really weird way ends up rejecting compromise and ends up rejecting consensus and rejects deliberation, right? So, yes, there are all these demographic changes, But the reality, but there's a subset of American citizens who are incredibly politically active now, who are now motivated to engage in what is the closest equivalent to radical political action that we've seen since the 60s and 70s to basically take over government. That's why they're not concerned about the debt limit. That's why they're not necessarily concerned about the government shutdown. And it's not, so we can't solely say it's because of demographic change, because demographic change doesn't prescribe the solutions. Demographic change, we can imagine a number of different ways that people can respond to demographic change. What we have to do is figure, is talk about this as a political project and talk about the political stories that this set of the community, that this set of American American citizens have. Right. And then when we think about solutions, I think what we have to do is actually move away in a weird, to a certain extent, from the idea that we have to, that talking is going to do it, because what they're in now is they're in such a tight informational bubble where it doesn't necessarily matter what people say to them, because they're not going to believe it.
Well, we have to get a short break and come right back there. There's some other points I want to pick up on. We are here with Dr. Lester Spence, with Bob Summerbee, with Anne McCarthy, looking at this great American divide in politics and life. What does it all mean? Why are we in it? Stay with us. We'll be right back. Come back and bring back my smile. Come and take these tears away.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, here 10 years dead, I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we continue our conversation here with Dr. Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Center for Emerging Media's Scholar in Residence, and author of the book Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. Bob Summerbee, editor of the Daily Howler, and Anne McCarthy, who is dean of the business school at Hamline University in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and former Republican candidate for comptroller here in the state of Maryland. And so, you know, I wonder if things are, on some levels, pardon me, so deep and so deeply entrenched, it's going to be hard for us to pull ourselves out of it. And I don't mean this to sound negative, but someone sent this morning, Jeff Singer actually, sent me an article that had been written by Heather Cox Richardson, who teaches 19th century American history at Boston College. A really interesting piece about a part of American history that, and I know a lot about Reconstruction, but I really was not aware of this particular moment in American history. And it was the first great shutdown in American politics, the American government. It took place in 1879. And basically what happened was there was a recession, and a lot of Democrats were elected to the House of Representatives. And almost all those people came in were some were former congressmen, but they were all ex-Confederates. And they formed this gigantic minority group inside the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives. And one of the big battles they were having at that period was to end Reconstruction, was to take the rights of to not allow federal troops to guarantee black voting rights in the South. So what they did was to gain power. This is when the yet-to-be Garfield, the President Garfield, was now minority leader in the House of Representatives, who's a Republican, who had fought in the Civil War and seen 27,000 men die who were Union soldiers in his command fighting what they called the revolutionaries, the Confederates, was a minority leader saying this is going to lead to the end of our government as we know it. They're using the Constitution to destroy government, because they were stopping the payment of anybody in government. What they meant was the federal troops, so they could shut down government so nobody could pay the federal soldiers to enforce the laws that were put in place after the Civil War. So this ended, and so this ended up in this gigantic battle, but they were able to freeze government. It ended up hurting them in the end because they lost a lot of their seats in the next election, but the precedent had been set, and Congress never addressed what the rules that allowed this to take place, for a minority kind of seize the government and take over. So I wonder if – a couple of things from y'all. One is that the story to me is just emblematic of – this is, to me, maybe – you know, that's just my way of looking at history and politics and my politics. But it's a direct link between this and where we are now in terms of who's in fear of what is in front of them in terms of the future of what America could be, and they don't want it to happen. And we have never dealt internally in the Congress about how to control this. And allowing these kind of things to happen. So it's interesting to me what that first shutdown was, and maybe and the link I see, and maybe you all don't see the same link, but I just want to throw that out there.
Well, the link I see is that each time there's been a shutdown, the party that's pushed the shutdown ends up losing in the next election. And it's shocking to me that this group of Republicans can't look back just two decades and see what happened the last time the Republicans forced a shutdown of the U.S. government. People don't like it. They may not like divided government, but they really don't like the government shutting down.
Gentlemen?
Yeah, they don't like the government shutdown. Of course, you know, we can't even do a good government shutdown anymore. I mean, there's so little that's being shut down. It's sad to see now. You know, I actually lost access to some educational data online. That's the whole shutdown. Yeah, last Wednesday, I went there, and it's like this sign: "Sorry, our website is down because of the shutdown, but everything else is running."
This is they redefined everything as essential.
The only thing that was not essential was educational statistics, which I was looking up from international test scores,
and the national park system.
Yeah. But there's no question there are regional patterns that recur over and over again. And, you know, before the break, Lester talked about the informational bubble in which this all works. That's the thing to me that just it frustrates me watching our national discussion play out, is that informational bubble where we're now breaking up into tribes that have hear different things, believe different things, are told different things. Think different things. The press is completely unwilling to address this, and wouldn't know how if they decided to try. You know, the two leading cable armies spend more time ridiculing each other than trying to clarify points. So we just have that's a tremendous bubble.
What's sad to me is that the Republican Party was the progressive party. And now it's almost the regressive party. I mean, it was the party of Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt. Those two men did great things for this country. And they were very progressive in their attitude, social attitudes. And now it's like a 180-degree turn.
So dealing with your exact question about those two, I've seen somewhat similar research, and I can't remember. I know it's folks at Rochester doing it. I remember the abstract. Maybe I'll put it online or something. But I think that there's something there, but it's important to note that it's not clear to me that if, let's say, for example, it's not Obama in office, but John Edwards, right? So focusing solely on racial dynamics would posit in this case that if we had a non-black president, the government wouldn't be shut down.
Oh, I don't think.
Yeah, and I don't think that's the case at all. Yeah, I don't think that's the case at all. I do think, though, that there is something, that there is a racial dynamic that makes it difficult for that once the Republican Party, and again, as obvious by Ann, there are a number of Republicans who have progressive ideas about race, progressive ideas about racial difference. But when the Republican Party at a national level made the decision to go after white conservative voters and to use implicit racial language in going after that voting class, that they created something, that they engaged in a tactic that has come back to bite them. And I say it's come back to bite them because by all measures, it's actually not the American people who have quote unquote crazy ideas about how the world works. That is to say, that has ideas about how the world works that does not fit the empirical reality. Right. something like Obama not being an American or Obama being a Muslim. There's not, that's not an American people thing. That's not a two parties thing. That is asymmetrical. It's only one party. It's the Republican Party, right? Similarly, attitudes about government among both Democrats and Independents have remained stable or increased, particularly among Democrats. But among Republicans, they've fallen like a rock, even in the wake of the Great Recessions. So we're talking about a series of ideas and a series of thoughts about the way the world works politically that's concentrated among the Republican Party, in part because of decisions they made in the late 60s and early 70s about how to remain politically viable in a context in which a number of people wrongly wanted to disassociate themselves from the Democratic Party solely because the Democratic Party all of a sudden became racially integrated.
Well, I hear what you're saying a little bit, but I'd say that the Republican Party was a pro-business party from Coolidge on, if not Hoover. And then in the 60s, it sort of merged into a small government because small government was more pro-business, less regulation, less red tape, you know, not the government looking over business's shoulder every second to tell them what they can and cannot do. But what I hear you saying, and where I agree with you, something after 1972, because I just don't think it's just a racial issue. I think it's also about Roe v. Wade. And after 1972, we saw a lot of defection from the Democratic Party. People who were unhappy about Roe v. Wade found a home in the Republican Party. People were unhappy about integrating the schools and Brown versus the Board of Education found a home in the Republican Party. And it became this kind of pro-business, small government. And then these almost like splinter groups forming its core. And I kind of take hope from Pope Francis. If he can say that the Catholic Church should be more about just gay marriage, abortion, and I can't remember the third one, it should stand for more than that, then the Republican Party should stand for more than that. It's an unholy coalition.
Yeah, I agree. And again, it's important to note, so the Republican Party makes this turn, and then there are a sect of members of the Republican Party that feel even more strongly. They consider themselves the equivalent of revolutionaries, right? So again, I point back to it's clear that the debt limit is going to make government cost a lot more. It's clear that shutting down the government costs government a whole bunch more. So it's not just the idea that government needs to be smaller that's driving them. It's a sense that government needs to be engaged, that the government we have is now illegitimate. And in order to render it legitimate, we have to engage in radical, radical, radical activity.
But, you know, it's interesting because the current Democratic president is Barack Obama, and the last Democratic president was Bill Clinton. And under the last Democratic president, the government was shut down, mm-hmm. and there were crazy stories about him. The crazy story about Barack Obama is that he was born in Kenya. The crazy story about Bill Clinton is that he had murdered, you know, and there were major cultural figures pushing that story for years. Jerry Falwell, you know, we didn't have the whole network then, but Jerry Falwell was pushing that story for years. As late as 1999, MSNBC and then Fox had Jennifer Flowers on for half an hour on Hardball, then for an hour on Hannity to talk about all the – in 99, talk about all the murders the Clintons had committed. This is how crazy – so the same pattern, crazy assertions pumped out to the base and the shutdown, this same pattern occurred under the last president. Now, what that pattern tells you about what's in the secret heart of that party and the people driving that party, I can't tell you. That's why I like to see MSNBC interview people from the other side and ask them, you know, and like to hear what they'd say. I'm curious. I don't know those people very well.
And what's even more striking, it was, you know, during W. Bush's time, spending, the party of small government increased the debt more than any other for 8 years, except maybe World War II.
Yeah, and it's interesting because people say, to defend that, or to stave off that claim, they suggest that conservatives had become increasingly upset with spending under Bush, but they never provide any empirical data for it because I'm not sure it exists. That is, I don't think you can find textual evidence of people who are fighting for small government now saying, or at least not significant textual evidence, saying while Bush was in office, oh, my God, this spending has got to stop. You know, oh, my God, no votes or anything. I don't think you have it.
I'll say this in fairness. When we talk about the deficit grew under Bush, that's true. But the deficit under Bush never, until the last year when the Great Recession hit, the deficit under Bush never got anywhere near where it suddenly was because of the Great Recession. And that was easily pinned on Obama, although he had nothing to do with it. That was just waiting there for him as the welcoming gift when he became president. But for people on the right, it was easy to tell, though. It was easy to tell voters. Well, you see, look at and it's still going on Fox. You see, look at the deficits under Obama and voters may not understand that did not come from any of his policies. That came from the crash that occurred in the last year of Bush. Bush's greatest deficit was nowhere vaguely near the first deficit of Obama, which was just a reflection of what happened to the economy.
So, I mean, and actually, you can look at the roots of that, and maybe that's part of where we are as well. The other example I'm giving was the U.S. economy not being where it once was, and America not being where it once was.
Right.
And that the roots of that go back to Ronald Reagan, go back to Bush, first Bush, go back to Bill Clinton, changing a lot of laws that governed the ability of banks and others to invest in a certain way that helped create this implosion in the American economy.
And in terms of anger, we haven't talked about the rise of the 1% and the suppression of income for everybody else, and which, of course, is almost guaranteed to form a background for anger and turmoil, whether people are articulating it that way or not. Stagnation of income, stagnation of prospects, future prospects for people. And that's been going on over the last several decades under both parties as plutocrats take control of both parties.
And we don't have an honest debate because of that.
Right.
In America, it seems to me, about what the future – how you change the economic future of the country. Because, you know, that debate's not taking place whether it is a market-driven response that some conservatives believe or people who are left to progressive believe, no, there has to be a much different response with greater government infusion of money to make it happen.
No.
That debate's not
taking
place.
Conservatives are told it's all about Obama and liberals are told it's all about the racism of the other party. And that's what you hear on cable. And that's very satisfying to each group of viewers. But that doesn't really get you anywhere. Doesn't get you very far.
Right. What were we going to say, Lester? I'm sorry. Go ahead. And then we'll go to Lester before we
I was going to say, you know who predicted this? Dwight D. Eisenhower. The rise of the industrial military complex. We're living with the fallout from that. Add to it the technology that allows people who invent technology to become the next millionaires and the billionaires and puts people out of jobs who had middle-class jobs. Instead of taking my taxes to an accountant every year who may charge me $125 and makes a decent living charging people like me to do that. Instead, I do it on Quicken or QuickTax. So I have displaced a person that I used to pay for a service by technology. Who makes the money out of Quicken? The guy who invented it. Not all the people on the call centers helping you figure out how to work it, right? I don't think we understand the degree to which technology has replaced the middle class in a great way.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's interesting because, I think you both are right about the quality of debate, about what people are debating about. But what these 30 or so Republicans show is that there are people who are debating and willing to do something about it. So then the question becomes, particularly given the way congressional districts are drawn, you know, like it's unlikely that these guys are going to be rewarded for their action. They're going to be politically rewarded for their action. The reason Boehner isn't doing anything is because and a number of other Republicans who really want to do something against their sect is because they think they're going to be punished in the punished electorally if they do something.
Right, in the primaries.
In the primaries. So then the question becomes for those of us who live in cosmopolitan areas that really can't make any changes to those congressional districts in the Deep South, you know, what do we do? You know, and I actually don't. The reason, to the extent that I talk about solutions, I talk about intensely local solutions in cities like Baltimore, is because in some sense, to a certain degree, I'm like, there's nothing we can really do about them.
It's fascinating to look at the way the House of Representatives gets elected now. In the last election, the Republicans have a 234 to 201, a substantial majority. And they got 1 million fewer votes nationally.
Yes.
And because Democratic districts are packed in urban areas with heavily Democratic vote and gerrymandering, which both parties do, but in this case,
right.
Republicans do it skillfully to create. So somehow, first you create a substantial majority getting not a great deal less than half the vote, but they got a million less votes than the Democrats did, and they came out with a 33-vote majority. Then you get into the House, and somehow 30 people out of the 234 can
yes.
stop everyone. It's just baffling to try to follow the way minorities of minorities of minorities get in control of everything. But it starts with a party getting a substantial majority in the House while getting a million fewer votes nationwide. And the logic of the Senate favors conservatives at this point also, because smaller states right now in our history tend to be conservative, and little Wyoming gets the same two votes that gigantic California does. And so we have a system that's so set up to favor minorities. But the House thing right now is fascinating in that regard.
I think that helps you too.
I agree with Lester, though. When I look at it at a national or international level, like it's like when I look at what's happening in the Middle East, I can't do anything about that. The only thing I can do is control my local area and try to work to create change in my local community and hope that change spills over into another community and that change, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because otherwise it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
Well, I think much of America feels overwhelmed at this moment. And I think that we've touched on some things here at the end of the conversation, which have to do with the way we have structured our political process in America that is, many people begin to think, is really antiquated, from the Senate to our gerrymandering of districts to the rest and how we elect people, that's just kind of arcane and kind of very 18th century, 19th century. And what Anne was raising about the issue of technology and the change of jobs and what we just barely touched on, which is whether or not we have an economic system left in America that can answer the questions that face Americans, which is part people are terrified about.
And the problem is it's hard for the 99% to confront the problems confronting Americans as long as we're still divided up into thinking, well, we're different groups. We're black Americans and we're white Americans and we're, you know. And as
women
long,
and men.
Yeah, right. And so as long as we're yelling at each other, you know, what I see in cable politics, this is divide and conquer. Plutocrats didn't invent cable news. They should have, because it's a way of keeping the 99% yelling at each other. And we're all getting looted in the process.
We have about 2 minutes left, so you can close this out if you'd like.
Yeah, I understand that. I just think it's important to note that, again, this is asymmetrical, right? So it's not necessarily black people against white people or men against women. It's a very, very small subset of Americans against everybody else. And, yeah, part of that is the 1%. But another part of that is a group of people who tend to be, but are not solely, from the Deep South and from places that used to be Confederate states, and now believe that that democratic democratic government that tends to aid non-white populations, that tend to aid non-heterosexual populations, that tend to aid women, are not legitimate. So for our discussions, yes, it's important to note that we've got something else going on than race, gender, and sexuality. But it's important to note that the people that we're fighting against actually believe something very different, and they're wielding a politics that ends lives based on that.
And I want to thank the three of you for being here with us. It's been a really interesting conversation we've had. We'll have to continue this kind of conversation in the coming weeks. We've been joined, you just heard Dr. Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, and author of the book Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of hip-hop and black politics. Dr. Ann McCarthy, who's dean of the business school at Hamline University in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and former Republican candidate for comptroller of Maryland here in Maryland. And Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler. Good to have all three of you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll meet some interesting opera singers from Morgan State University.